I'm Matt Jolly, and this is History Worth Saving. In 2018, the Pew Research Center discovered the majority of Americans, 57%, say they only know some of their neighbors. 23% of adults under the age of 30, they have no clue about who any of their neighbors are. 58%, nearly 60% here, say they've never met up with their neighbors at a party or even a get-together. In the city, it's a lot worse. 24%, 28% in the suburbs, 40% out in the country, they say they know some of their neighbors. They got to help do the work around there. But if you pay attention to the news right now in our country, we are on the verge of becoming more tribal than ever. When you combine all of this division with the fact that we really don't know those who live closest to us, well, that paints a scary picture. It's hard to like someone you don't know. It's hard to be empathetic towards a cause or even have an understanding of why something should be saved or torn down if you just don't know. We need to get to know our neighbors. And that's what History Worth Saving is all about. This is just you and me sitting down having a conversation with someone we should get to know. No complicated production, I promise, no fancy edits, no twisting of words. This is just a conversation. But it's only going to work if you help. And my hope is that you'll bring people to this table, people that you and I should have a conversation with. Maybe it's the lady down the street saving the local theater, the man who makes sandwiches for the school kids in Macon, Georgia, just because they're hungry. Simply put, I want to talk to your neighbors, and at the end of the day, it's these stories that are history worth saving. St. Peter, he stands at the gates of heaven, and Beau L'Amour guards the West, at least his father's version. Beau is the caretaker and the writing partner for his father's literary estate, the works of America's favorite storyteller. As we said in our opening season, Louis L'Amour, the most powerful man in the West. Beau L'Amour, his son, joins us right now. Beau, thanks for being here.
Hi, Matt.
Do you know your neighbor?
I know a couple of my neighbors, yeah.
See? We're off to a good start.
But, you know, it's Los Angeles. I don't necessarily know a lot of my neighbors.
Well, here's where I want to go with this. Your father's stories, they often depend on neighbors. I mean, they're either the good guy or the bad guy, but usually the stories from the West, they paint a picture of people coming together to solve a problem, to render justice, and I don't know, maybe there's something there. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but I kind of think the world needs a little Louis L'Amour right now.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I lived, it's an interesting thing about neighbors and people knowing one another. And, you know, sometimes you want, sometimes you want more privacy than your neighbors can give you. And sometimes it's wonderful to have all of these people in your community. It's, I've lived in small towns where, you knew everybody and a lot of people were kind of up in your business. And I've lived in big cities where you didn't know too many people, but people were very nice about leaving you alone. So it's just a mixture of feelings and, a mixture of attributes depending on wherever you are. I also lived for about a year in Australia where probably because of the very low population density, everybody is exceptionally friendly. I mean, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. So I don't know. I kind of go both ways about it. I wish I'm very happy to know more about my neighbors and have my neighbors know more about me. And at the same time, you know, I think that as much as everybody knows, if everybody's willing to give the other people a certain amount of space, that's a very good thing.
It's a very LA answer, isn't it? I mean, as you've often said to me in our conversations, people went out West to try something new, to kind of get away from everything. But we see that sometimes in your dad's writings, though, and I think that that's interesting that it's pulled forward, even even out of those stories today. Tell me what's new, because you do have, I want to get this right off the bat. There's a new release coming out later this month in November.
The Louis L'Amour's Lost Treasures Volume 2, which is the part of our a program that we have been working on for a few years, is now kind of winding down. And so Louis L'Amour's Lost Treasures, to a great extent, tries to tell the story behind the story of a lot of aspects of my dad's career. Probably the most important part of it are a series of postscripts that I have put into his old novels that sort of tell the story behind the story of that particular novel, what was going on in dad's life, what he was trying to do with his career, things of that sort. And each one of those is different. If you were to look in the new edition of Down the Long Hills, you would find a bunch of information about a sequel to that story that my dad intended to write, and a few chapters of the beginning of that sequel. If you were to look into the postscript that is in the novel Caligan, that's all about us driving around in the Mojave Desert, researching the forts along the desert road, which was the military road that connected Arizona to the Los Angeles area. And so, many of them are very different. The one for Kiowa Trail is not out yet, but that postscript has a lot to do with my dad's friendship with Katharine Hepburn. He actually wrote that story for Katharine Hepburn, although by the time he got it out, she was very busy taking care of Spencer Tracy because he was, not doing very well in the last few years of his life. And that, never turned into a movie with Katharine Hepburn, but he definitely had intended it for her. And so there's a different story in each one of those. And then the Lost Treasures Volumes 1 and 2, the second one, which I just mentioned, is coming out this month in November, is those are pieces of stories that Dad didn't finish, or treatments, which is a description of a story that a writer will put together for a publisher or a movie company to try and sell that story. So a treatment is, it's not really the same as reading a short story or a novel, because like I said, it's kind of a description of what the writer will do rather than the thing they will actually do. But those can be, anywhere from 3 or 4 pages to 40 pages. And there's also a couple of unpublished short stories in these books. And I take whatever piece it is, whether it's unfinished or finished, and try and say what Dad was trying to do with it, and where he was in his career when he was writing it. And if it's unfinished, I use his notes and outlines and things like that to sort of project forward what might have happened in the story and how he might have gone ahead to wrap it up. The third piece of Louis L'Amour's Lost Treasures, which came out last year, is his first novel, which was unpublished from, the 1930s, which he started writing in 1938. And it's called No Traveler Returns. And it's a piece of one of what we call his yandering stories. So the first type of thing that Louis ever tried to write in his life were more kind of maybe Hemingway-esque stories about his early life and the environment that he lived in when he was traveling around the world as a merchant seaman and traveling the country as a hobo and sometimes prize fighter. And so he wrote a number of those stories, and they're published in the short story collection Yandering, and then there's this novel No Traveler Returns, which kind of caps off that that part of his career.
And I want to put in a plug for that, because it is an excellent work. I enjoyed it. That's where we met.
That's correct.
When you were promoting that book, and it's covered on a previous episode of yours on this story and show. So I appreciate that. It was a great read.
Thank you.
How does this fit in to his narrative overall? I mean, when you look at these, there has to be something that kind of stands out personally to you. Maybe a surprise. Are you still finding that while you work
I'm
on
definitely,
this?
Yeah, I'm definitely still finding surprises. It was in the beginning when I started to prepare the Lost Treasures material for publication, I thought that I might have an interesting story for a number of the individual stories, but it would be, you know, just the individual stories. And one of the things that I discovered was that there really is an overarching narrative there of how Dad started writing. He got some success in the pulp magazine world, writing all kinds of different stories, crime stories and adventure stories and things like that. And then after World War II, the demand for Westerns was tremendous, and he started writing Westerns. And he broke into the business of writing paperback originals, so novels, by writing Westerns. And then as soon as he had some success under his belt, some 12 to 15 marginally successful Western novels, he wanted to branch out and start writing things in other genres. And the publishers were just not interested in that. They wanted to keep him selling the thing that was very popular and that he was doing fairly well with. And he struggled for a few years to try and break out and do other things, and nothing was effective. And then he kind of backed off and said, okay, well, if nobody wants my non-Western genre material, I'm going to start trying to change the Western genre and how my fans understand what I'm doing. And I'm going to write things that everybody can comfortably call Westerns or frontier stories or something like that. And so not be bothered by the fact that I'm adding these other elements. And so, he slowly started interjecting new and different aspects into the Western novels. He did a contemporary Western, set in the late 50s or early 60s that sort of flashed back to cover an event in the Old West. That's the Broken Gun. He did a couple of kind of international Westerns. So Riley's Luck is the best example of that, which takes place in the 1870s and 80s, but a lot of the action in Riley's Luck occurs in Europe at that time. And then he did some things that took place on the early frontier, say just before and after the Revolutionary War. He went back to the earliest times in American history, kind of Elizabethan England and what was going on in the on the frontier in the United States at that time. And then he wrote stories like the Californios and Haunted Mesa, the Californios in particular being a transitional one because it takes place in California in the 1830s in a Spanish and Mexican California where the people from the United States are the illegal immigrants. And it also has an element of science fiction to it. And so he basically started trying to stretch the Western genre and make it someplace where he could play around with new and different ideas in a way that writing traditional Westerns would not. I knew that he did all those things. What was really surprising was to discover that he had planned it, and mm-hmm. that he'd basically made one attempt to break out of writing Westerns, and then he made this other attempt to just sort of change how people perceived Westerns in a way that would allow him to do different things. He never talked about that. Never heard him say a word about it when I was a kid. But when I started doing my research, the plan was pretty obvious.
That's interesting. I guess he'll truly arrive as a, as an American entertainer and author when they start performing his works on stage in modern time, like they do with Shakespeare, right? That's when they remake the movie, you know, and it's modern time. But that'll be interesting to see. What a cool insight there. What do you think he'd say today? I mean, where we're at, what would Louis's advice be right now to all of us?
When you say where we're at, what are you talking
right
about?
Right now on the cusp of 2020, what do you think he'd have to say to us right now? If he just popped into the room, what would he say sitting here at this table?
Oh, I don't know. Probably just calm down and take the long view of things. My dad lived through some very, very radical periods. You know, he was on his own working as a longshoreman and a merchant seaman and a miner and a lumberjack in the 1920s, times when the strife between, let's say, labor and management was so severe that, you know, labor blew up things that belonged to management and management machine gunned labor. There have been wild times in the United States, and I think he would basically say, you know, you guys haven't gotten anywhere near what I've seen in my life.
Buy my books. I think it's fascinating to go back through. I still love one of my favorites, and I know you worked on some of this, but The Education of a Wandering Man. It kind of lays out his path, and I think it's a great book. I think it's a necessary reading for just about anybody. It should be.
Well, it definitely shows how reading has a, you know, what kind of an impact that reading can have on someone. My dad, you know, didn't make it through the 10th grade, and the family kind of fell on hard times and had to live on the road, traveling from job to job. And he, you know, he made up for his lack of education by reading everything he could find. If you were to go on our Louis L'Amour's Lost Treasures website and poke around, you'll have to poke kind of deep. I'm not going to walk you through the exact menu of how to get there. But if you poke around a bit, there's a list of pretty much every book he read between 1930 and 1988. And you know, it's hundreds and hundreds. I shouldn't even say it's hundreds. It's thousands of books. And you can see how he was, you know, he was really managing his own education. Mm. In some ways, it was much better than a university education. In some ways, it wasn't quite the same thing. And that the wonderful thing about a university education, at least in the days when it was functioning at its best, was there was a great interplay of ideas, and students would react to one another's ideas, and professors would react to students' ideas, and everybody would have their ideas challenged. And I think my dad lost out on that, but he certainly did more book study than, you know, almost anybody ever did in their college education. That's for sure. Many times over.
That's one of those qualities of an exceptional human, right? I mean, I think we all have exceptional qualities, but to for someone like your father to have the, you know, the wherewithal to, I'm going to keep a list of everything I've ever read. That's pretty impressive. You don't hear about that a lot.
Well, he was highly motivated. His family had been, you know, not well off, but they had been middle class, and his older brother and sister in particular had gotten a fairly good education and had gone on to really make something of themselves intellectually. So his the oldest member of his family was his sister, and she had gone on to be she'd gotten a good education for a young woman in the, you know, late 19th century and early 20th century. And she had gone on to college. She had been a librarian. She had been a school teacher. She had been a high school principal. And then after a hiatus, she ended up, and this is would be after World War II now, at the point I'm at. She went to work, I believe, as the first secretary, first kind of executive secretary, who was supposed to rein in and control the intellectual output of the Stanford Research Institute, which, you know, studied all kinds of incredibly wild stuff. I mean, everything from ESP to what neighborhood to locate Disneyland in. And they were a major think tank. They still are. And then Dad's brother, his oldest brother, was an aide to a number of politicians. He was the foreign desk editor for the Scripps Howard newspaper chain. So he was handling, you know, he was basically the guy in charge of all of the foreign correspondence that they had. He was the intelligence officer for the port of New Orleans during the beginning of World War II. And then he went back into his press role and covered the four-party conferences, four-power conferences at Yalta and Potsdam and things like that. So, I mean, he was like right at, he was sitting there taking notes while the guys who, you know, figured out how to fight World War II figured out how to end it. And then he was assistant or secretary to one of the U.S. ambassadors to mainland China, or nationalist China, Chiang Kai-shek's Chinese government, right before they left the mainland to go to Taiwan.
An interesting family, nonetheless. But
yeah, and so, well, Dad was, you know, Dad was sort of the poor final child who didn't benefit from the stability that his older, you know, that his older siblings got. But they were definitely, you know, he knew he kind of had to compete with people like that, even though he was sort of growing up on the road while they traveled around with everything they owned tied to the car. And his older brother and sister were already off doing things that they were doing in the world, but they were always a role model of one sort or another. And he, you know, I think he felt like he had to intellectually live up to a model that they were setting.
Let's talk about their nephew a little bit, because I think this is interesting. Here you have had this this sort of ringside seat to all of this, Bo, and you yourself, you're always working on something of your own. What are you toying with right now? You were talking about the Stanford Research Center, and that kind of got my mind going on some topics there. But what are you working on right now? What do you find interesting?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what you're asking. I'm finishing up Lost Treasures. That's still. That's still something that has a few. Okay. There's a few more postscripts to be managed, and I'm not yet to the point where I'm planning the next, you know, whatever the next project will be. But there's, I mean, at the moment, I'm kind of hip deep in corporate administration.
And, so nothing fun on the workbench personally.
Not at the moment. I'm hoping that in the future there'll be things, okay. But at the moment, I'm unfortunately my desk is covered with Excel spreadsheets.
Well, yeah, that's no fun. I mean, that's not exciting.
No, it's not.
So, but it's necessary, isn't it? I mean, that's necessary. It's part of it.
The type is very small, and I've been bending over these things for so many weeks. I've got my neck out. So, you know, at the moment, I'm just doing the necessary sort of things to keep the family business running.
I had a friend that sent out this this picture, and it was really poignant. It said, it was the differences between busy people and productive people, and I'm squarely in the busy category right now. So so 2020 is not going to be busy. I've decided it's not going to be busy. It's going to be productive. Your dad was a productive guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, he was extremely motivated, you know, probably because he'd spent so many tough years, and he felt that his career had been interrupted. It had taken a long time to launch, and a long time for him to really learn his craft. And then right when he was getting going, World War II hit, and it was, you know, he had to restart his career completely after the war. And then the magazine fiction business collapsed, and he had to start again and create a new career for writing novels. And, you know, by that time he was pushing 50. And so he didn't really get to the point where he could enjoy, any certain amount of, wealth or celebrity or anything like that until maybe the last decade of his life. And so he was working very hard, and he was very, you know, he was very motivated. But, you know, when you talk about the difference between busy and productive, he was very productive, but, you know, it's interesting. His whole thing was, you know, get your butt in the chair and type new stories and just produce more and more and more and more. And the fantastic thing about it, the kind of mind-bending thing about it, was I'm still straightening out the debris that he left behind. I mean, he was so productive that I don't even think he had any idea how much stuff he was creating or where he put it or anything else. I mean, it just, there's, you know, it's only been the last few years, and he's been gone for over 30, that, that I really feel like, you know, we finally got to the end of organizing all the stuff he left behind.
How often do you hear his voice in your head when you're working on this stuff?
Oh, not at all. I mean, you're talking, you know, I kind of know what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, you said one time that you have his styles figured out, the different genres, but I'm wondering how often it just, you're able to pull that out, or is it just mechanical at this point?
I think my being able to write in various styles that he had throughout his career, is not really the same thing as hearing his voice. And Dad's writing was fairly different from his actual personality. So those two things are separate from one another. And you know, I know fans don't like to hear this. They really like to feel like, you know, if they read a particular writer, they really understand that person from reading their professional output. But my take on that, everybody is welcome to their own, you know, to their own, opinion on it. But my take on that is that, you know, almost everybody that I've ever met, who is a creative type person in one way or another, has a difference between their personal voice and their professional voice. And, you know, if you live and work around Hollywood, you always see it when you see some completely inarticulate kind of numbnuts actor who you've worked with, and you know, when they're in their personal space and they're not acting, or just when they're in their "I'm worrying about what I'm about to do" personality before they actually go on stage or in front of the cameras and do their thing, you know, they're kind of a bundle of neuroses. And then they step out and they do the thing that they're professional at, and they're incredibly buttoned up, you know, and they knock it out of the park. And then you see them on a talk show or something, and they're speaking like they're actually a normal person and they actually live their life making sense. And you go, no, these are three totally different people. Okay, there's sort of the private person, right. There's the professional person, and then there's the public person, and those are three totally different personalities. So Dad was different than his writing. You know, it's like I deal with his personal personality all the time as I just try to execute the things he left behind in a way that he would be proud of. And I, you know, I can perform some of the styles of his writing to the point where I can't tell where I did it and where I didn't. And there's one, you know, kind of the last sort of style of writing that he had in his life, which was a little more kind of flowery use of language and things like that, which I'm not very good at that one. But luckily he was, you know, what he was doing was so buttoned up by that point that I don't really ever have to jump in and play that part. Now, just as a caveat to all of that, because I've been talking about saying, oh, I'm to do this writing as my dad and I do this and I do that. We've never made up we've never published anything where I or anyone else was writing as Louis L'Amour. There's never been a whole story that was, you know, that was kind of made up and stuck out there that nobody's ever faked being Louis L'Amour. Where I have done that is where I've gone in and fixed things that weren't finished or needed to be polished or needed this or needed that, whatever it was. If anyone ever doubted whether or not somebody else was writing the Louis L'Amour novels, I just welcome them to read Louis L'Amour's Lost Treasures, Volumes 1 and 2, which is, you know, at over 30 unfinished works. If we were interested in faking it, we would be finishing those. But so, you know, I try to make his material as enjoyable as possible to the public, and I also try and leave it alone as much as possible, depending on, try and strike a balance between those two things.
I think it's great. And I think there's a lot of lessons we can learn from your dad and from his writings. And I think it's a lot of fun. At the end of the day, that's what it's all about, right? It's about hearing a good story. And now the second volume of Louis L'Amour's Lost Treasures are out. Bo, how did I do? We're at the end.
I think
now.
You did very well.
I think
you did great.
Is this going to be a conversation worth having around a table with other people, you think?
I have no idea.
Just no help.
Well, it's a conversation we had.
Yeah, it's a conversation we had. I hope someone else will come on and have a conversation, because I think these are important. I think, you know, you, when I asked you to do this, you said, well, what's this about? What's this about?
Well, now and I have a little better idea.
I think this is what it's about. And anyway, I'm going to leave it there. But Bo L'Amour, thanks for coming on the first episode here of the History We're Saving podcast. I don't know what we're going to call the other things we've done this far, but this is a podcast, right? This was right down the line of a podcast. No edits. Thanks, Bo. Appreciate your help.
Thank you. Take care.
Find more History Worth Saving at historyworthsaving.com. I'm Matt Jolly. Now go meet your neighbors. See you next time.